Good morning, everyone.
So today we're going to be reading in Book 2, Canto 4, The Kingdoms of the Little Life. It starts on page 132. In the previous canto, Shobindo showed us the glory and the fall of life, the wonderful realms which are the native home of life, the heavenly realm of pure bliss and delight, and all the wonderful levels that are there, and the beings expressing different aspects of life energy and delight. But Aswapati found that although he could see those worlds, they were revealed to him, he could not enter them, because there was something in his human nature that was still tying him down to the image of a life full of grief and suffering. That was part of the problem that he is trying to solve. Why is our life so undivine? If its origin is divine, how has it become this unsatisfactory, troubled life that we know? And at the end of Canto 3, he showed us in the last section how life entered into the material world, hoping to fill a fair new world with joy, pour all her blessings, her delight, her powers. But while the magic gift was on its way, before it could reach our hearts, our aspiring hearts, a dark, ambiguous presence questioned all. She gets swallowed up by this dark power, a mystic mask of death and pain is imposed on her, just the opposite of her free, pure, native bliss. She's in our world, she has become imprisoned in matter, you know? And she has become the guest of these dark powers. To feed death with her works is here life's doom. So we went on and we read the first three sections of the next canto, which led us to page 137 at the break. So if you like, we can start at the beginning of the canto and study these three sections. Or perhaps we can read the fourth section before we do that. The fourth section begins at the break on page 137. These first four sections together form a kind of introduction to the main theme of this canto, the kingdoms of the little life. Sri Aurobindo is going to show us three kingdoms. The life that's completely involved in matter, the life that's beginning to awaken up to some kind of plant and animal consciousness, and then the life in which the beginning of some mental awakening comes. These are the kingdoms of the little life that will be described in this canto. So what do you say? Shall we just go on from where we are? Read through the first three? Let's read the fourth one. Yes. So the last sentence of section three is on page 137 before the break. It says, "It was a vain, unnecessary world whose will to be brought poor and sad results and meaningless suffering and a grey unease. Nothing seemed worth the the labor to become. If someone from another world had come and seen the life evolution at that point on Earth, they would have said, well, forget this world, what's the point? But Aswapati doesn't see it like this. Would you start, Alice? Page 137 at the break. You've forgotten
there's
your glasses.
Lots of light. There's lots of light. And no pun intended. There's lots of light. No pun intended. Okay. But judged not, so his spirit's wakened eye, as shines a solitary witness star that burns apart light's lonely sentinel. In the drift, the teeming of a mindless night, a single thinker in an aimless world, awaiting some tremendous dawn of God. He saw the purpose in the works of time, even in that aimlessness. The work was done. Planet, magic, will, and change divine. The first writhings of the cosmic serpent force uncoiled from the mystic ring of matter's trance. It raised its head in the warm air of life. It could not cast off yet night's stiffening sleep, or wear as yet mind's wonder flecks and streaks. Put on its jeweled hood the crown of soul, or stand erect in the blaze of spirit's sun. As yet, we're only seeing foulness and force, the secret crawl of consciousness to light, through a fertile spine of lust and battening sense. Beneath the body's crust, a thickened self, tardy, fervent, working in the dark, the turbid yeast of nature's passionate change, ferment of the soul's creation.
Thank you. Dara?
A heavenly process dawned this gray disguise. All ignorance in its covered night labored to achieve its dumb, unseemly work. Camouflage, the inconscient need to release the glory of God in nature's mind. His sight, spiritual, and embodying forms, would pierce through the gray phosphorescent haze and scan the secrets of the shifting flux that animates these mute and solid cells and leads the thought and longing of the flesh and the keen lust and hunger of his will. This too be tracked along its hidden stream, its acts to a miraculous fountain, a mystic presence, none can probe nor bloom, creator of this game of ray and shade in this sweet and bitter paradise, asks from the body the soul's intimacies by the swift vibration of a nerve, links its mechanic thoughts to light and love. It summons the spirit's sleeping memories up from subconscious beds beneath time's form, oblivious of their flame of happy truth, arriving with heavy eyes that hardly see, they come disguised as feelings and desires, like beads on the surface float a while, and rise and sing on a somnambulist tide.
Thank you. Margaret?
Impure, degraded, though her motions are, always a heaven truth blooms in life's deeps. In her obscurest members burns that fire, a touch of Godhead's rapture in creation's acts, a lost remembrance of felicity lurks still in the dumb roots of death and birth. The world's senseless beauty mirrors God's delight. That rapture smile is secret everywhere. It flows in the wind's breath, in the tree's sap. Its youth magnificent. flowers, and life broke through its half growth in the plant that feels and suffers, but cannot move or cry. In bees and in winged bird and thinking man, it made of the rhythm its music speed. It forced the unconscious tissues to awake and ask for happiness and earn the pain and thrill with pleasure and laughter of brief delight and cure with pain and crave for ecstasy.
Mm. Jocelyn?
Who never achieved, voiceless, in on this truth, too far from light, to prove beings for. Born strangely dying from eternal bliss, it places on art's core and vibrant nerve. Its sharp self-seeking tears of our consciousness, pain and pleasure have but sting for cause. Instinct with it, but blind to its true throne, the soul's desire lives out towards passing things. All nature's longing drive none can resist, comes surging through the blood and quickened sense, an ecstasy of infinity of course. It turns in us the finite loves and lusts, the will to conquer and have to see and keep, to enlarge life's room and scope and pleasure's range, to battle and overcome and mix one's own, the hope to mix one's joy with others' joy, the yearning to possess and be possessed, to enjoy and be enjoyed, to feel, to live.
Mm, thank you. Bhuvana.
Human was a brief attempt to be, its rapid end of momentary delight, whose stamp of failure haunts all ignorant life. Entwined still its habit on the self, the phantom of a dark and evil star, ghostly pursues all that we dream and do. Although on earth or form established life, a walking of habit or a sense of law, a steady repetition in the flight, yet all its moods of it ever the same. These passions are the stuff of which we are made. This for the first try of the awakening world. It clings around us still and climbs the world. Even when reason is born and soul takes form, in beast and reptile and in thinking man, it laughs and is the fount of all the life. This too was needed that breath and living might be.
Mm, thank you. Bom.
The spirit in a finite ignore, master is breathing all out.
Master is rescued, so its present consciousness burst out in little jets at quivering points. From the inconscient seed in infinitude, then slowly it gathered mass, looks up at light, its natural life lives tied to her origin. A clutch of nether force is almost here. Out of unconsciousness, depths of instinct leap, a neighbor life to insentient note. Under this law, an ignorant world was made.
Thank you. Paula.
In the enigma of the darkened vasts, in the passion and self-loss of the infinite, when all was plunged into the negating void, non-being's night could never have been saved if being had not plunged into the dark, carrying with it its triple mystic cross, invoking in world time the timeless truth, bliss changed to sorrow, knowledge made ignorant. God's force turned into a child's helplessness can bring down heaven by their sacrifice. A contradiction founds the base of life. The eternal, the divine reality, has faced itself with its own contraries. Being became the void and conscient force, nescience and walk of a blind energy, and ecstasy took the figure of world pain. In a mysterious dispensation's law, a wisdom that prepares its far-off ends, planned so to start her slow aeonic game.
Thank you. Marianne.
Excuse me. 9:3:22. Can bring down heaven by their sacrifice. Who sacrifices?
It's these things, being, bliss, force, all these things, by their sacrifice, by turning into their opposites, they can bring down heaven into the material world. Yeah. Line 332, a blindfold search.
Search in vessel and crumbling clasp of a half-seen nature and a hidden soul. The game of hide-and-seek in quiet wounds. The play of love and hate and fear and hope continues in the nursery of mind, its hard and heavy bond of cell-borne wounds. At last, the struggling energy can emerge and meet the voiceless being in wider face. Then can they see and speak, and verse to verse, in larger consciousness, the clearer light, the two embrace and strive, and each know each, regarding closer now the playmate space. Even in this formless coiling, he could feel matter's response to an infant stir of soul. In nature he saw the mighty spirit concealed, watched the weak birth of a tremendous force, pursued the widow of Godhead's tentative face, heard the faint rhythm of a great unborn news.
So we can go back to the beginning of the canto and look more closely at what is being shared with us in this canto. Page 132. Jean-Yves, what do you read?
It's the beginning of
the canto, right? Sorry?
The beginning.
The beginning of the canto, yeah. Page 132.
A quivering, trepidant, and sudden word. Born from the dolorous meeting and eclipse, appear in the emptiness where her feet have trod, a quick obscurity, a seeking star. There was a rising of half-conscious force, hardly awakened from the unconscious sleep, tied to an instinctive driven ignorance, to find itself and find its hold on things. Inhabitor of poverty and loss, assailed by memories that fled when seized, haunted by a forgotten uplifting hope, it strove with a blindness as of groping hands to feel the aching and disastrous gap between earth pain and a bliss from which I fell.
Thank you. From this meeting of life and matter, He says it's a dolorous, painful meeting and an eclipse of all the life and energy and beauty of the life goddess. This meeting gives rise to a new world, a quivering, trepidant, it's full of fear and hesitation, uncertain world is born from that dolorous meeting and eclipse. And it appeared in the emptiness where the feet of the life goddess, as she poured all her beauty and joy on the world, where they had trod. It's a world of quick obscurity, of seeking stir. Here the word quick is used with its double sense. We speak about the quick and the dead, those who are alive and those who are not. Quick, of course, means with speed, with the possibility of speed. So there is an obscure which is living, alive. There's a stir, there's a movement which wasn't possible in the purely material world. And it's carrying with it some seeking. There's some longing, some dissatisfaction. Those who are alive, we are quick, and the dead. We speak also about feeling cut to the quick, means to the living flesh. No? I suppose in trees there are parts which are more or less solidified cells. But if you're a gardener, and you want to prune off the dead twigs, you will look for the quick, the part where there's life. You know, there's inside, there's some life. So that's why, you know, if somebody says something very, very painful to you, you say you feel cut to the quick.
It's also the term used for the first sensation of the movement of the fetus.
Yes.
In the mother.
It quickens.
It quickens, that's the word quickening. And it also was indicated, at least in the world of the Christian Catholic people, that indicated the descent of the soul.
Right. Yes. So because of that quickening, of that awakening in the material world, there was a writhing. This is what worms do. If you're digging in your garden and you come across a worm, it writhes and wriggles and tries to get away from you. Or a snake writhes, especially if it's hurt, if it's damaged. So this is of energy, of half-conscious force. It begins to move, no? But it can't move much. It moves with difficulty because it's hardly awakened from that stiffening sleep of the inconscient. And that writhing is tied to an instinct-driven ignorance, a state of beginning of consciousness, but it's driven by instinct rather than conscious thought. But it's driven to find itself and to find its hold, its grasp on things, its understanding of things. So that world, that trepidous, trepidant, uncertain world, is inheritor of poverty and loss. The contrast between the richness of life's native home and this state she now finds herself in, assailed, attacked by memories that she can't quite recall, that fled when seized, but she's haunted by a forgotten, uplifting hope there's something that gives some kind of hope. That world strove with a blindness as of groping hands, hands searching about in the dark, to find something that can fill that aching, disastrous gap between earth pain and the bliss from which life fell. There's such a contrast, such a gap. Faint memories, some hope, longing to fill that disastrous gap. That is the characteristic of this world. Mihong.
A word that ever seeks for something missed, hunts for the joy that earth has failed to keep. Too near for our gates, it's an unappeased unrest for peace to live on the inert solid glow. It has joined its hunger to the hunger of earth. It has given the law of craving to our lives. It has made our streets need a fathomless earth. An influence entered mortal night and day. A shadow overcast the time-born race. In the troubled stream where lives a blind heart pulse and the nerve beat of feeling wakes in sense, dividing matter's sleep from conscious mind. There strayed a call that knew not why it came.
Thank you. Anything to ask or share?
What is the appeased unrest?
I'm sorry, I'm not hearing you properly.
There is a line too near to our gates. It's unappeased unrest.
Unappeased unrest, yes. Unsatisfied. You appease somebody by giving them something that puts them at peace, that soothes them. So this is, he says, a world. It's not exactly our world, but it's very near to our world. I think perhaps we can say that it's the most material level of the vital, of the life levels. And this world, that world, of course, is in our bodies, in our substance. It's always seeking for something missed. That's why we have our perpetual dissatisfactions.
It's trying to look more at it for peace to live on the inner solid globe.
It is too near to our gates, or its unappeased unrest is too near to our gates for peace to be able to live even here on this inert solid globe, this globe of pure matter. Still there's this stir of dissatisfaction. Seeking world has joined its hunger to the hunger of earth, and it has given the law of craving to our lives. It has made our spirits need a fathomless gulf, a bottomless, unappeasable need.
So the law of craving, it's like hardwired?
Yes, hardwired, yes, absolutely.
That's because of the gap.
It's because of the gap, yes. It's because of this union of life with all its urge for delight, power for enjoyment, with the inertia of matter. There's a contradiction that has brought about this craving, the law of craving into the world. This is what makes the transformation of matter so essential. Asvapati is seeing that, first of all, he sees that some kind of transformation of life must happen. But that in itself is not enough, because the needs of life are here in our very substance and in the earth matter.
And in this line, then it's saying that if this is possible, then peace would be possible to live.
If we could recover that capacity for delight, yes. A world that ever seeks for something missed, hunts for the joy that earth has failed to keep. Too near to our gates, its unappeased unrest, the unappeased unrest of that life world which has appeared at the junction of life and matter, has joined its hunger to the hunger of earth, the natural hunger and dissatisfaction of earth, which we read about in the previous canto, no? The young gods craving, famishing for speech and life and love, for sensation. And this has deepened the need of our spirit to a fathomless gulf. Don, would you read? 22, an influence.
22, an influence entered.
Yes.
An influence entered mortal night and day, a shadow overcast the time-worn race. In the troubled stream where leaps a blind heart pulse and the nerve beat of feeling wakes incense, dividing matter's sleep from conscious mind, there strayed a call that knew not why it came. A power beyond earth's scope has touched the earth. The repose that might have been can be no more. A formless yearning passions in man's heart. A cry is in his blood for happier things. Else could he roam on a free, sunlit soil with the childlike, pain-forgetting mind of beasts, who live happy, unmoved, like flying flowers and trees? The might that came upon the earth to bless has stayed on earth to suffer and aspire. Infant laugh that rang through time has hushed. Then the natural joy of life is overcast, and sorrow is his nurse of destiny. The animal's thoughtless joy is left behind. Care and reflection burden his daily walk. He has risen to greatness and to discontent. He is awake to the invisible. Insatiate seeker, he has all to learn. He has exhausted how life's surface acts. His being's hidden realms remain to explore. He becomes a mind, he becomes a spirit itself. In his fragile tenement, he grows nature's lore. In him, matter wakes from its long, obscure trance. In him, earth feels the Godhead drawing near.
Thank you. So if it weren't for this influence, no, we could roam on our free, sunlit soil of paradise with the childlike, pain-forgetting mind of beasts, or live happy, unmoved, like flowers and trees. There's something in us that longs for that paradisal state of simplicity, you know, and thinks, oh, if we could get back to that, you know, but we can't. The only answer is to evolve further, and Shobindo evokes that further movement in what Don read, you know, that we've left behind the animal's thoughtless joy, and now care and reflection burden our daily walk. But man has risen to some greatness and to some discontent, some aspiration for even greater greatness. We're awake to invisible possibilities, and somehow within us there's this insatiate seeker who cannot be satisfied. He has everything to learn. Where did we stop? Oh, we went to page 30, line 50, no? So he has exhausted now life's surface acts. We know all about that, the physical world, physical action. But we are still need to explore all the hidden realms of our being. This time-born race, man, he becomes a mind, he can become a spirit and a self. In this fragile tenement, this short-lived body we are housed in for a while, he grows lord of nature, the leading species. And in man, matter wakes up from its long, obscure trance. In him, earth, the material power, feels the Godhead drawing near, the approach of divinity, of divinization.
Sure. You know, there is a tendency among people to go to a simpler life.
Yes,
back to
we long for a simpler life, that's right. We think that would make us happier.
Do you think?
Yeah, we think so. He says it's impossible because this law of craving is there, no? And actually we are here for a purpose. We are not here just to be simply happy. There's much more to be done.
The craving has an evolutionary effect.
Yes, craving is the mark of an evolutionary urge, in fact.
But we can say this craving is a point, it's actually an aspiration of nature in man.
Right.
But it introduces another following question. What, when the next stage in evolution is achieved, which is not the man, what will be the destiny of the man after this stage is reached? Whether it will return to his childlike stage, because this aspiration shifted to a new species to achieve new adventures, or you remain troublesome animal?
I think what Sri Aurobindo envisages and what he describes in The Life Divine is a very, very much more fulfilled and conscious state.
I see this as a development of consciousness.
Yeah, it's about the development of consciousness.
Simply you become more and more conscious.
And the awakening of consciousness in matter is painful. Somewhere else he says, pain came first. No? Pain and joy are like twins, but out of when twins are born, one is born first, and it was first pain. And it's through the spur of pain that matter has become more conscious, living matter has become more conscious. And it's still like that. All our painful dissatisfactions, our suffering, are a reminder and an invitation to evolve further, no?
Otherwise there could be inert stillness, it wouldn't go on.
Yes.
You're satisfied with that simpleness, multiplicity.
So that's why there is this this ladder of worlds. Each of them represents a stage in this evolutionary advance. No? First there was first we read about the world stair. Asvapati was given this vision of all the different levels. And then, of course, we are on the base of matter, but then subtle matter, and then life. And Asvapati first, as he examined this, he saw the troubled kind of life that we have. But then he was shown or told, it was made clear to him, that this troubled life actually is an expression of something that has a much, much higher origin.
Much higher origin.
Yes, I love to to read that. It's the end of the first section of the previous canto. After describing the perversity of life on earth, no, aspiring to heaven, she turns her steps towards hell, fate's dreadful swing she has taken for cradle and seat, this is life. Yet, pure and bright from the timeless was her birth. A lost world rapture lingers in her eyes. Her moods are faces of the infinite. Beauty and happiness are her native right, and endless bliss is her eternal home.
Would you say this craving begins in the subconscious or in this level of life here, the little life?
Perhaps they correspond, Patti. Perhaps the consciousness of this world of little life, it's this.
It's a sign of waking up out of complete unconsciousness.
Right, yes. Of that particular level of waking up. The level, first of all, of the very simplest life forms, the ones, the molds and the slimes and the, I don't know what they're, viruses and bacteria and things
protozoa.
Like that.
Mm-hmm. Protozoa.
Protozoa, exactly, yes. And when you look at that, you think, well, what use is that stuff, that slimy stuff? Mm-hmm. But that's an absolutely essential stage in the development. And it's interesting that this stage actually dominated life on Earth for 300 million years, something like that. And then there was a kind of pralaya. We don't know exactly what it was. Some people say that another planet hit the Earth. There was a complete destruction. No? And when after another, I don't know how many million years, after that destruction, then complex life emerged. And there they have many, many fossils and so on. They can see the amazing complexity, a kind of outburst of incredible, fantastic creatures, almost all of whom have become extinct, no? But a few species have evolved to go on and become creatures that are still about today. Somebody was telling me, somebody who knows something about evolution, he said he'd only recently noticed how very, very precisely here in this canto, Sri Aurobindo follows the course of life evolution as it is understood today.
And this whole urge to find something missed, because he says, a world that ever seeks for something missed.
Mm.
So that urge to grow is itself a type of craving.
Yes, yes. Craving is its characteristic.
And that little sprout and that wants to keep coming up.
Yes, right.
So it's not necessarily a bad thing.
No, not at all. That's what he's showing us, no?
I thought that there was the difference there between longing and craving.
Very difficult to distinguish.
Longing is not being.
I mean, the positive word is aspiration. Hmm? Mm-hmm. Yeah? But perhaps these words that are not so positive, they're also forms of aspiration. Less conscious, more subconscious, instinct-driven.
Craving seems to be more immediate than what it now. I want. Longing is.
Well, that's a question of degrees of intensity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Craving is more physical.
Perhaps.
You crave for chocolate.
But our language is metaphorical, so we can use these words that have a physical significance. We can use them for, they are used, and extremely so here in the poem, for psychological meanings.
Yeah.
When Mother uses the word transformation, she means some towards something better necessarily, right?
Yes.
Because she had said, I've often wondered, you know, about this resurrection thing, today being Easter. Because Sri Aurobindo verifies that there was a crucifixion. He talks about that in
one of the aphorisms.
But resurrection, she only said it is a symbol of transformation. So I was always curious about that. If it ever, you know. But maybe it's just, is it just a symbol of him coming out of the tomb? The whole idea of this life
no,
waking up
if,
is the kind of coming out of this darkness.
If we think of the resurrection as a symbol, it's a divinization of the physical. No. He wasn't anymore in a material body. He was in a divine body, and he could move around and talk to people, and finally he could leave in that divine body.
It's become like a celebration of spring along with that Christian.
Yes, that's of being rebirth, a rebirth.
Interesting.
So let's, where are we now? I've even lost the page. We read to line 50, didn't we?
Yes.
So now we've got line 51. Yes. Sudhanya, what do you read?
An eyeless power that sees no more its aim. A restless, hungry energy of will. Life cast her seed in the body's enduring mold. It walks from happy brotherhood to blind force, comparing it to sense and see and feel. In the enormous blur of the void, returning to her dreams, the past routine, dead road of the surrounding universe, the mighty prisoner struggle for release. Alive with her yearning, of her inner self, in the heart she killed the fire of passion and need. Amid the deep calm of inanimate things, arose her great voice of pride and fear and strife. A groping consciousness in a voiceless world, a guideless sense was given her for her work. Thought was with her, and nothing now she knew. But all the unknown was hers to feel and grasp.
Let's pause there. It is miraculous, isn't it? I mean, how can we understand it? We can only understand it in this way, that how does matter, atoms and, you know, inorganic matter, how does it become organic? As the entrance of another force. It's the force of life, which wakes up what could become a cell, something physical, not anymore just pure matter.
But it can open up only if it has the potential, no?
Yes, the potential, obviously.
I mean, if you have the seed in the soil is not opening up. I mean, it's hosting that little seed, but only because that seed has the potential to become a plant,
yes.
Isn't it?
That's
it takes from the soil.
Huh?
That seed takes from the soil.
Actually,
soil
itself is organic.
Feeding from the soil.
But rock, what... it was sea and sky and stone. There wasn't actually any soil. Soil is itself organic, no?
Yeah.
There was stone, and somehow that stone has become alive. It becomes soil. It becomes the support of plants.
Chemically speaking, Sridhar,
yes.
When you have carbon enter into the molecules, the inorganic become organic. You have carbon always in
but carbon is not in itself organic.
No.
It's a catalyst or something that allows something
yeah.
to happen.
When it becomes organic, you have carbon. Mm.
Somewhere he speaks about slimes and molds. I think this is one of the theories that the living cells, they might have come from sticky mud. But anyway, it's a mystery. But Sri Aurobindo expresses it to us like this, no? That it's that wonderful divine power and force of life which enters into the material world, into the world of sea and sky and stone. But with that meeting, life loses its freedom of action, all its urge to delight and movement and change and variety is still in the life principle, but it's imprisoned in matter, and that leads to these to this craving and this feeling of being trapped and imprisoned and needing to break out. So here, I think, is the next stage, is this development of the senses. Which is this groping consciousness in this voiceless world. She's given a guideless sense. There's the possibility of feeling. It's given to her for her road. That's the way to progress. There's no thought, she doesn't know anything, but the whole unknown universe is there for her to feel and to clasp and grasp hold of. And that's perhaps in the very first single-celled creatures, is that capacity to feel the difference between light and dark, heat and cold, salty and sweet, and this is the way that it moves.
Shadavan, what you also said already, I think it's so important that we are become all more aware, no? That this, he writes here, a restless, hungry energy of will with a big W, that there was this force, the divine, to bring all this.
There was this will and intention to make it. Yes.
That is not just by random also, but there is
a purpose and a direction, for sure, yes. So that is the great gift that Sri Aurobindo has, one of the great gifts he has given to us, this awareness. No? And perhaps some of you have heard me speak about this British physicist Brian Cox before. He's become quite a star, I think, talking about physics. And he has followed an earlier physicist, Schrödinger, in seeing this mysterious principle, life, as a process. And when he examined all that, he understood that urge, that will, must have been there from the very beginning of what they call the Big Bang. It must have been involved there. And if otherwise, no. And that is the factor that unites all life, wherever it may happen in our universe. And then I thought, well, he should take a step further and see that if this is true of life, it must equally be true of consciousness. If we see consciousness evolving, it must also have been there from the very beginning.
This verse is to rest and energy of will.
Yes.
So, is it the energy of will which is rest and hungry, or is it the hunger of will?
No, I think it's this, it's the will itself is hungry. And I think this might be what Bergson called l'élan vital, you know, this life force exerting its pressure.
If you're wrong concerning your last remarks about physics.
Yes.
In these days, by this window with the turbulent physics, which are theories based on a Italian physician, his name is Ettore Majorana, was born in 1906, was a collaborator of Enrico Fermi, the one who discovered the electron bomb. Then suddenly it disappears in 1938, on his way from Palermo to Naples. Most probably he withdraws in a monastery to perfectionize his theories. He, as a physician, says that there are 11 dimensions. 10 physical dimensions are subtle physical, and the temporary dimension, which is number 11. This is a very, very, very interesting thing. As a matter of fact, Lydia sent me to take it to you because I printed out that I've forgotten. Now you're talking about. So there's a website where you can read about all those things. There's one that's called www.3rdmillenniumphysics.world.
You have to write it to us there.
Yeah, I can send you a mail. I sent the whole lot. Because last year in San Diego, in America, there was a nice congress about this third millennium physics. Anyway.
It's called Third Millennium Physics?
Yes.
That's key to get to these websites.
Just type Third Millennium Physics. www.3rdmillenniumphysics.world. And there's another one, www.voyageindestiny.org. And I have a nice PDF that starts with the very beginning, and then you get the Big Bang, and after the Big Bang, etc.
So this is the this is the emerging knowledge, no?
Yes.
But you can send it to Prasad and he send it to all out. You send it to Prasad and he will send it all out.
We have a mailing list, I can
send
it.
Okay,
thank you.
I can't remember things, that's the time.
So where are we? It's 11:45 already. Yes, we finished page 133. Now we would start next time perhaps at page 134. He speaks next about instinct. Oh yes, at the beginning Prasad prayed this wonderful sentence about life. This is about the life goddess. It's in the middle of line of page 134. Adorer of a joy without a name, in her obscure cathedral of delight, to dim dwarf gods she offers secret rites. But vain, unending is the sacrifice. The priest, an ignorant mage, who only makes futile mutations in the altar's plan and casts blind hopes into a powerless flame. This is an amazing image of life participating in the universal process of sacrifice. Life at this ignorant stage, driven by sense and instinct. She adores a joy, a delight that she has no name for. It's an instinctive attraction that is driving life. And her temple, it's an obscure cathedral, dark and misty, one can't see clearly, but it is a shrine to delight. And she's the priest. She's performing the sacrifice. Or she has a priest who performs it for her. She offers secret rituals that are secret to us. We don't know what is going on to these dim dwarf gods. They're not the great gods. They're the small, dim gods of life. She's doing that tirelessly, offering this sacrifice. But that sacrifice is in vain. It never achieves anything. because the priest, the one who's performing the sacrifice, is ignorant. He doesn't know how to perform the sacrifice properly. So what does he do? You know, there's the altar and there are all the sacred objects that you can use for making the sacrifice. But all he can do is kind of shift them around. He makes futile mutations in the altar's plan. And there is a flame, there's always a flame for a sacrifice, no? But all he can do is to cast blind hopes into a powerless flame. I find it so poignant and so true. I see in the world around me, I see us all the time making futile mutations in the altar's plan. We think that we're going to make progress if we change this or that or the other thing. I'm always moving the furniture around in my house. But in our communal life, it also happens, you know, have a change in the land board or the whatever it is, because we don't have the knowledge. The urge is there, but unless we have the knowledge, we can't make a really powerful sacrifice. The sacrifice always has some effect, not desired effect.
And was this because of the one?
Sorry?
All this because of the one? We saw in the previous canto,
yes,
that one has put a kind of curse on
this dark, ambiguous presence. Yes, but even this, you know, in the next line on page 130, line 517, so 18, he says it's the secret will. It's the will for evolution. That clothes itself with night. It offers to spirit the ordeal of the flesh. To make all this real in material terms, a divine life on earth, all these stages have to be passed through. And the early stages look very unimpressive and pointless or worse, no, distressing. But it's all part of this process of evolution towards divinity.
I keep getting this question about tears, the first moisture.
I'm not hearing you very
well. Oh, okay. Impression is that there's a moisture that comes out of the eyes.
Yes, tears.
There's tears of delight and frustration, and you know that the water, because nothing can exist. We talked about the earth. You can't grow anything without moisture.
How true,
yes.
So there are the five elements. No? There's earth, water, air,
fire,
ether. Ether is the substance of spirit. No? Earth is matter. Life can only come, as you very rightly say, with the union of water and earth. And then air is also important. And air for us represents sky, mind, fire, flame, aspiration. But in the traditional order, they also say that the forms only come with flame, with fire. I think we got ourselves a bit tangled up there today. Shall we stop there?
Thanks to Sri Aurobindo.